The headlines this hour: Iran and the European Union say talks on reviving the 2015 Iran deal will resume in the coming days. Tens of thousands of British rail workers stage another strike over pay and job security, bringing the country's railway system to a standstill again. Also coming up, Ukrainian forces preparing for a full withdrawal from the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk, bringing Russia closer to the capture of the Luhansk region. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran and the EU have agreed to resume the JCPOA revival talks in the coming days.
We hosted Mr. Borrell and Mr. Mora and his assistants. We had detailed and accurate and profound talks regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran's demands. I emphasized that we are prepared to resume the talks in the upcoming days.
Amir Abdullahian says that Iran wishes to continue the path of diplomacy in order to break the stalemate in the Vienna talks. He stressed that Tehran is seeking result-oriented negotiations. The minister also criticized the recent anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA for complicating matters regarding the Vienna talks. Amir Abdullahian once again reiterated that the Iranian nation must benefit from the JCPOA economically. He called on the U.S. to act realistically and responsibly regarding the 2015 accord. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a joint presser with the EU coordinator, Joseph Borrell, in Tehran. Borrell said the two sides have agreed that his visit to Tehran will be followed by the resumption of the JCPOA talks. He said reaching an agreement in Vienna will be of great significance for global stability and security.
I cannot underline the importance of reaching an agreement on the basis of the text they put on the table and how important it is for all of us, for Iran, for the world, for the Europeans certainly, but for the world as a whole, to have an agreement on the JCPOA. The world needs security and stability, and the world will be a much secure place if we have a deal that can ensure for Iran full benefits, full economic benefits of the agreement, and at the same time to address the concerns of the international community.
The top EU diplomat urged all parties to the 2015 deal to move forward towards the full implementation of the accord. He also underscored the need for the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran in order for the accord to get back on track. Borrell said the European Union is seeking much deeper ties with Persian Gulf states in various fields, including in trade and regional security. He noted that implementing such an approach is impossible for the bloc without taking Iran into account. Borrell expressed the EU's wish to strengthen its relationship with Iran, which is a big energy provider and a big market in the region. He stressed the two sides have enormous potential to boost economic ties, especially in the fields of oil and gas. Professor at the University of Tehran, Fuad Izadi, explains Washington's role in the deadlock faced by the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
As Borrell said, there is a deadlock in the talks, and the problem that exists is in Washington. In the U.S. Congress, people, senators, powerful people, oppose U.S. returning to JCPOA. They say this very clearly, both Republicans and Democrats. Robert Menendez, who is the chair of Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, said this in public about 2 weeks ago when he was talking to Robert Malley as the witness that the Senate had invited. So with this chaos in Washington, the opposition to JCPOA is quite severe. There's a lot of politics going on. And if the American officials were honest, they would say that we have internal divisions. We cannot return to JCPOA. And that going to be a true statement. In reality, that's not what they're saying. They're engaging in this type of blame game. They want to blame Iran for talks not succeeding.
Iranian national Hamid Nouri, who is in solitary confinement in Sweden, has spoken about his ordeals in an audio file released on Friday. He has criticized human rights organizations for letting him down by failing to give him a chance to speak about the ordeals that he went through. Nouri also said that the last court session held nearly 2 months ago lifted some restrictions against him. Despite that, he added that he is still being kept in solitary confinement. Also, he has been denied visits and phone contacts with his family. Nouri was arrested in November 2019 upon arrival in the Swedish capital. He's accused of rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization in the 1980s. In April of this year, Swedish prosecutors requested life imprisonment for him. Iran says the allegations against Nouri are baseless and his trial is a political show. Resistance movements reacting to Israeli plans to create an anti-Iran regional alliance. Lebanon's Hezbollah has rejected claims on forming such an alliance as an empty threat. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General says the group attaches no importance to the claim, but stays alert to respond to likely threats. Sheikh Naim Wassem pointed to Arab countries that have normalized relations with the regime, saying that it is a disgrace for them to want to form a military coalition with Tel Aviv. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the new Israeli plan is much more dangerous than some Arab countries normalizing ties with the occupying regime. The Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said last week that the regime is working with Arab states to build a U.S.-led air defense alliance against Iran. On Friday, Jordan's King Abdullah said he supported the formation of Middle East alliance similar to the Western-led NATO. An investigation by the UN Human Rights Office has concluded that veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists covering an Israeli raid in Jenin were targeted by, quote, seemingly well-aimed bullets.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Britain's railway system grinds to a near halt as once again railway workers walk off their jobs in one of the biggest strikes in decades. Only a skeletal service of railways will be running, with heavily reduced hours. Tens of thousands of rail workers staged the walkout demanding pay rise and job security. Railway unionists say the wages have failed to keep pace with the UK's surging inflation. They also want the threat of compulsory redundancies to be withdrawn. Talks over workers' demands have failed to break the impasse, leading to the railway's third strike this week. Britons are dealing with soaring living costs, as inflation has gone past 9%, the highest rate in four decades. There are fears that the strike would provoke similar action in other industries. Moving on now to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, officials in Kiev say that they have ordered troops to withdraw from the Severodonetsk, a key battleground city in the eastern Donbas region. Officials say that they aim to avoid more casualties and allow forces to regroup, as very little are left to defend the city. The withdrawal marks the biggest retreat by Ukraine since the loss of the southern port city of Mariupol last month. The pullout is also seen as a significant Russian victory over Ukraine's eastern commercial hub. The war, which began 4 months ago, is now focused on the eastern Donbas region. With the fall of Severodonetsk, its adjoining city of Lysychansk is likely to become a new battlefield in the east. Recent Russian advances appear to bring it closer to taking full control of the Luhansk province. That is a key province in Donbas. Fears that the Russia-Ukraine war can lead to a wider conflict are growing as tensions keep escalating between Moscow and Kiev's Western supporters. In the latest development, NATO countries have taken more measures against Russia in response to its move to cut off gas. That has raised concerns that the Ukraine war can easily turn into a direct confrontation between Russia and the West.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed. All of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences.
Well, tensions have been escalating between the West and Russia over a number of issues. For example, Russia is strongly opposed to the West's military support for Ukraine and has already warned of serious consequences. And now Moscow is outraged at the EU for what it calls blockading Kaliningrad, a Russian exclave in the Baltic.
Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is not just expanding towards the Russian border, an issue that is one of the causes of the current war in Ukraine. Now, this US-led military alliance is also expanding its hegemony in Africa under the pretext of supporting the African Union in its peacekeeping missions. A NATO official speaks here after the signing of an agreement with the African Union officials in 2019.
The signing ceremony that we've just had is a really significant event. It is a technical agreement between NATO and between the African Union, and this will allow us now to expand our political and our practical cooperation.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on NATO's expansion in Africa and how the presence of this US-led military alliance is spreading instability in Africa. Our analyst will be speaking on some of the covert objectives of NATO in Africa. In the second segment of our program, we shall see how Chad is the latest African country to witness anti-France protests. We're asking, why are Chadians angry with France? Stay with us as our experts give us their take on these topics, and please send your comments through our social media handle.
NATO expansion in Africa. NATO is a treaty organization created in 1949 by the United States to maintain its military and political power over Europe. Since the early years of its existence, this U.S.-led military organization established covert and overt military operations in Africa during the Cold War. NATO set up the Allied Forces Southern Europe, AFSOUTH, in Naples in 1951, and then the Allied Forces Mediterranean, AFMED, in Malta in 1952. Western powers established these military formations to garrison the Mediterranean Sea against the Soviet Navy and to create platforms from where they could militarily intervene in the African continent. NATO's war in Libya was its first major military operation in Africa. Former dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled from power after a popular uprising in 2011, which was hijacked by NATO through an imperialist military intervention. NATO interference in Libya without the approval of the African Union plunged the country into chaos.
Former Zimbabwean President, the late Robert Mugabe, in his 2012 address at the general debate of the 67th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, months after Gaddafi was toppled, warned of NATO expansion in Africa.
Mr. President, we recognize that there are existing and emerging threats and challenges that continue to frustrate our individual and collective efforts to attain greater economic development and social progress, as well as peace and security. But the increasing trend by the NATO states, inspired by the arrogant belief that they are the most powerful among us, which has demonstrated itself through their recent resort to unilateralism and military hegemony in Libya, is the very antithesis of the basic principles of the United Nations. In that case of Libya, the African Union and its peacemaking role was defied, ignored, and humiliated.
Well, for more on NATO's expansion in Africa, we have contacted John Philpott, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Well, thank you, and it's very nice to talk about world problems, especially in 2022.
Now, what is NATO really pursuing through its out-of-area operations in Africa, a continent which poses no existential threat to this Western military alliance?
Well, NATO shouldn't really exist, since it was formed to fight communism and the Eastern Bloc folded in 1990. NATO serves to be a U.S. military and political instrument to exercise U.S. power. And whether someone poses a threat or not to NATO in Europe is not the question which one has to ask. It's whether or not the U.S. can promote its strategic and economic and political interests militarily. And obviously, the U.S. is under threat of rivalry. There's kind of a non-aligned movement being born in Africa. And NATO, as the political and military branch of the United States, will attempt to be involved in Africa, as we saw in Libya in 2011.
Well, as Mr. Philpott mentioned there, a classic case of NATO meddling in Africa is Libya. NATO and the United States led the destruction of Libya in 2011, and the aftermath of that was instability in North Africa and the entire Sahel region.
What's the interest of NATO in the Sahel, especially considering the fact instability continues to plague the region despite the presence of military forces from NATO member states?
The question which one has to ask, and asking the question provides the answer, does the U.S. or NATO like countries to be balkanized or fragmentized? And the answer is yes. And the first, in the last generation, the most important example is Yugoslavia, which was broken up. They like fragmented countries. There's been an attempt to, in the last 30 years, to break up the Congo, and U.S. think tanks want the Congo to break up. It's a country of, I think, 95 million.
Kwame Nkrumah warned in 1967 that there were at least 17 NATO air bases, 9 naval bases, 3 intercontinental ballistic missile launch sites, and 1 nuclear test site in North Africa. Now, has the situation worsened in terms of NATO presence and militarization of Africa since Nkrumah's warning?
Yes. Well, the U.S. established under George Bush in 2007 and 2008, the African Command. It's called AFRICOM, which is ironically based in Germany, but it has 29, I think, bases in 15 different countries, and there's operational work being done in other countries. And the U.S. is into almost every African country. Their biggest base is in Djibouti, and some countries have refused, like Eritrea, Zimbabwe, and I think there's other ones. So the U.S. is omnipresent in Africa, ostensibly to fight terrorism, but the reason is U.S. strategic interests, in my opinion.
Last May, British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace and Spanish Defense Minister Margarita Robles addressed a joint press conference in Madrid and claimed that Russia's expanding influence and activity in Africa pose a worrying threat to the security of NATO countries. However, despite pressure from Western countries, the African Union chairperson, President Macky Sall of Senegal, visited Russia recently and met President Vladimir Putin in the southwestern Russian city of Sochi and explained Africa's position regarding the conflict in Ukraine.
You have seen the different votes at the United Nations. The position of Africa, despite enormous pressure, the majority of African countries have avoided condemning this situation.
For his part, President Putin said Russia will continue to develop ties with African countries.
Our country has always been on the side of Africa, has always supported Africa in its battle against colonialism. We think that with Africa in general and its individual nations, we traditionally have very good relations. I would even call them friendly relations without exaggeration. Africa as a whole has a huge potential, and based on that, we will continue to develop our relationships with Africa and its individual nations.
Now, with the growing influence of China and Russia in Africa, are we going to see increased NATO presence in the continent? And is there a likelihood of a flare-up between these global rivals in Africa?
My understanding and what I read is that the Russian way of working in Africa is different. Similarly, there's a lot of relationships with China. And China's building infrastructures, and it has fairer relationships with Africa. There are difficulties, of course. That's called bilateral problems. And there's been a lot of negotiation and improvement of relationships with China. So, I guess I'm from Canada. Canada's a mining country. Toronto is the center of mining. They do not negotiate. They impose contracts with 15-year limits on arbitration, and they go into countries, mine them out, leave all the refuse, the leftover mining slag and things like that, make people get sick from different types of illnesses related to the mining, and walk away from it.
Now, lack of a strong African military force ready to enforce peace remains a major challenge, and this has made the continent vulnerable to Western imperialist powers. Now, how can African countries disentangle themselves from dependency on Western military assistance in maintaining peace and security in the continent?
Well, I mean, it comes down to AFRICOM out of Africa, U.S. out of Africa, which is a bit simplistic, but national sovereignty is very important, and they have to look, countries will have to look out for their interests and negotiate on a country-to-country basis for their development and refuse the dictates of the United States. And you are, your country has been under U.S. dictates. We can see how the U.S. does not negotiate. They impose. They try and force a country to accept their point of view. And that can't go on.
Well, the onus is on African countries to resist U.S. dictates. That's what our guest for today, John Philpott, says. We'd like to thank him for his insight on NATO's expansion in Africa. Our next topic for today is on the recent anti-French demonstrations in Chad. But before that discussion, we shall take a short break, so stay with us.
Hello.
Nigerian Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Zubairu Dada, recently visited Iran, leading a high-ranking delegation to participate in the 6th Iran-Nigeria Joint Commission. The event saw the two sides signing multiple cooperation documents envisaging cooperation in tourism, oil, agriculture, and sports. During his visit to Iran, the Nigerian Minister of State for Foreign Affairs paid a visit to the Saipa Group, a major Iranian automaker. Speaking to Press TV after visiting the Saipa factory, the Nigerian minister said he was fascinated by what he saw.
Wonderful experience of learning what it is that the Iranians are doing and doing for themselves and for the nation. I'm very much fascinated, and I believe all members of my team are just as fascinated with what we've seen.
On the tremendous technological advancement in Iran despite sanctions, the Nigerian minister said sanctions have enabled Iran to look inwards.
Is the mother of invention, isn't it? I guess what the sanctions have done is to make sure, I mean, the Iranians look inwards and to challenge themselves to find out what it is that they can do from within and to do for themselves.
On trade between Iran and Nigeria, the Nigerian foreign minister says the trend is upward, but it's still far from satisfactory.
And from the little that we've been able to see, I mean, I'm convinced there is a lot that we can do together. And what that means, of course, is that through this collaboration, we can up, as it were, our game, up the ante, and, you know, raise the volume of trade between our two countries.
Anti-French protests in Chad.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Chadians have taken to the streets recently in several anti-French protests called by the country's opposition leaders.
Angry protesters expressed their opposition to France's military presence in the country and support for transitional president Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno, who has been in power since his father Idriss Déby Itno was killed by rebels in April 2021.
A member of an opposition coalition speaks here during a protest against France in Chad.
What right do they have to accept that French people who are not accepted in West Africa have the right to come back here? By what right? Nobody knows about it. If they are strong as that, they can go and make war in Ukraine.
Now, to discuss the anti-France sentiments in Chad, we have contacted Inem Richardson, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. She's also an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Thanks, madam, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, why are the people of Chad opposed to the presence of French troops in the country?
Well, one thing you have to realize is that it's not just the people of Chad, but really all across West and Central Africa, especially in the Sahel, French troops are seen as a form of military occupation. If you look at the history of the region, since the late 50s, early 60s, France signed really dark and really manipulative neocolonial contracts that granted the country permission to intervene militarily in the region, which they've done time and time again. So if you look at, you know, throughout the entire region, we see that France was just recently kicked out of Mali, but they have a strong presence here in Burkina Faso. They have a presence in Niger. They have a military base in Dakar, even though Dakar tends not to be oftentimes thought of or included in this conversation. So all across the region, France is seen as not just a former colonial power, but a neo-colonial power, and one that's never really changed its role in the region very much.
Chad's military transition is struggling to win over a population exhausted by 30 years of French-backed autocratic rule. Anti-French sentiment is usually high among protesters, who blame France for backing the current and previous military regimes against the will of the people. Why is the French government supporting President Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno, who has been in power undemocratically since his father's assassination in 2021?
Well, France doesn't just support undemocratic leaders in its former colonies and across the African continent. France actually directly installs various governments that France knows will serve its interests. So for decades, France had a very close relationship with Idriss Déby, and now that former President Idriss Déby has passed, France is now backing his son, current transition president, Mahatma Déby. See, if we look at across this whole region, even just next door in Cameroon, we see a very similar legacy that France has left behind, where after killing the Cameroonian revolutionaries in the UPC, France installed a Ahidjo's dictatorship in Cameroon for 40 years, which is now a 40-year-long Paul Biya dictatorship that's supported directly from Paris.
The transition to civilian rule, including an inclusive national dialogue promised by military authorities, has essentially hit a roadblock. Now, this is despite a promise made by the military ruler when he took over power.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period.
The transition to civilian rule in Chad has essentially stalled, and the military ruler seems to be entrenching himself in power. Now, what's the reason for this deadlock?
Well, it's likely that the current transition president, Mohamed Déby, believes that as long as he has enough support coming out of Paris, that he's probably fine. And if you do look at the history that I outlined, he does have reason to believe that he could maybe stay in power for a long time without a civilian transition if he gets enough support from Paris. However, we also see that things are changing in the region. Tensions are getting really, really heightened. People are, they've had, you know, enough of French intervention in the region. They don't want these French-backed presidents anymore.
Amid the transitional crisis in Chad, the country has established ties with the Israeli regime. The unpopular move by the military rulers in N'Djamena is seen as a betrayal to the Palestinian cause in this Muslim-majority country. Why is the Tel Aviv regime looking for its ties with Chad?
I think this is extremely strategic for Israel. We have to understand that Israel recently was granted observer status from the African Union last year, but this is something that's very contested. It's not something that that it will be easy for Israel to hold on to. The Sahel region of Africa, you know, on a popular level, naturally has an affinity with the Palestinian struggle. This is a part of the world that has been colonized, sometimes directly occupied for several decades, much like Palestine has. It's a part of the world where in some parts, such as in Chad, people do speak Arabic and it will have direct access to some information coming from potentially Palestine and other parts of the Arab world. And it's also a largely Muslim region, and Israeli Zionism sometimes does use or often uses Islamophobia as a form of justification.
Now, our last question. It seems anti-French sentiments are now widespread across West Africa. Now, do you think Paris is going to face tougher days in its former colonies?
Yes, Paris is already facing tougher days right now. They were kicked out of Mali, and that's what people want to see all over the Sahel region, and all over all sorts of different former parts of the French Empire that want to see France leave. So I think France is already in a really rough position already right now. I think we have to be aware that, you know, France could change its strategy. It's just tried to sort of reform things and soften things. There was an Afrique-France summit in Paris held by Macron last year that was all about, you know, cultivating friendship, which is a classic French move. But I do think that we have to be aware that France could change tactics, become a little bit less overt, because there's no way for France to hold on to power in the very overt way that it's moving right now. The tensions are just so heightened, and people have just had enough of whether it's the military, whether it's the French-controlled currency, or various forms of French enterprises operating throughout the region. You know, a lot of violence coming from Paris towards this part of the world.
Well, there you have it. African countries need to remain vigilant as neo-colonial powers such as France are adopting covert policies aimed at continuing their domination of the continent. I'd like to thank our guest, Ineme Richardson, for her incisive analysis. And with that, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati habni libtida'i karamak wa salifi birrika bi ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi أتراك معذبي بنارك بعد توحيدك وبعد من طوى علي قلبي من معرفتك ولهج به لساني من ذكرك واعتقده ضميري من حبك وبعد صدق اعترافي ودعائي خاضعا لربوبيتك
Brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were discussing this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. Ya Ilahi wa Sayyidi wa Rabbi, my Allah, my Master and my Lord, aturaka mu'adhibi binarika ba'da tawhidik, can you be seen tormenting me with your fire after I have professed to your oneness? Wa ba'da man tawa alayhi qalbi min ma'rifatik, after your cognition my heart has embraced, وَلَهِجَ بِهِ لِسَانِي مِنْ ذِكْرِكِ, and the remembrance of you my tongue has constantly mentioned. In this regard, first we discussed the concept of oneness and believing in monotheism as one of the things, as one of the first and foremost things the prophets have invited the people to, which is monotheism and denying earthly deities, in a couple of programs. Now we can move on to this part. وَبَعْدَ مَنْ طَوَى عَلَيْهِ قَلْبِي مِنْ مَعْرِفَتِكِ, after your cognition my heart has embraced. We have mentioned a couple of times earlier on that one of the most significant requisites for the acceptance of a prayer is the true knowledge and recognition of the Almighty Allah, the true ma'rifah, and belief in His absolute power and strength. The servant needs to believe that the Almighty Allah has power in actualizing the asks and the different requests of the servant. It has been reported from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, had you recognized Allah with the recognition due to Him, your prayers would have dislodged the mountains. It is also reported that once Imam Sadiq alayhi salam recited the verse, is not he the one who answers the call of the distressed when he invokes him? أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءُ. So he was asked, why is it that we invoke but we're not answered? Imam alayhi salam replied, because you invoke one whom you do not recognize. You pray for what you do not know. This tradition, dear listeners, emphasizes on the importance of the role of the supplicant's awareness of the reality and object of prayer and of the one who is asked from in the acceptance of prayer.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity, and despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity? No, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَبَعْدَ مَنْ طَوَى عَلَيْهِ قَلْبِي مِنْ مَعْرِفَتِكِ, after my heart has embraced your cognition, I have totally believed in you. And this cognition and belief not only is beneficial in the acceptance of prayers, but also in keeping us away from the fire of hell. أَتُرَاكَ مُعَذِّبِي بِنَارِكِ, can you be seen tormenting with your fire after I have professed to your oneness, after your recognition my heart has embraced, after the remembrance of you my tongue has constantly mentioned? In one interesting tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, the Holy Prophet sallallahu has said, Allah the Almighty, the Majestic says, whoever asks me, knowing that I am the only one who harms and benefits, then I will surely answer him. This simple recognition of the Almighty Allah that He is the absolute cause is the secret to the vast ocean of His mercy. In one of his supplications, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, you have lauded yourself for having no need for your creatures, and it suits you to have no need for them. You have attributed to them poverty, and it suits them to be poor toward you. So he who strives to remedy his lack through what is with you and wishes to turn poverty away from himself through you has sought his need in the most likely place and come to his request from the right quarter. We also have different reflections of the importance of recognition in our whispered prayers or munajat. Imam Ali alayhi salam says in one of these whispered prayers, immaculate is he on whom relies every believer and of whom every denier is in need. And no one can become needless except by the grace of what is with him. This simple belief is everything. And that's why we read in Sahifa al-Alawiyya, who can do harm to you or fight against you or be beyond your reach or be safe from your decree? The servant needs to know that it is only Allah that knows the different ways of salvation and destruction. He has to rely on Him in asking from Him, so that he may not pray to Allah for something which there might be his own perdition in. The Holy Quran says, وَيَدْعُ الْإِنسَانُ بِالشَّرِّ دُعَاءَهُ بِالْخَيْرِ وَكَانَ الْإِنسَانُ عَجُولًا. Man prays for ill as avidly as he prays for good, and man is over hasty. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.